Hi, everyone, and welcome back to On Becoming. We took a little holiday break. I'm so excited to be back with you. And I cannot be more thrilled to introduce you to my next guest, who, if you are a French woman, you have probably heard very much about already, Lily Babary-Coulon. Lily is a published author, a Kundalini yoga teacher, and really a blogger extraordinaire. She is one of the most influential and prolific voices in wellness today. In 2018, she published a cookbook, Pimp My Breakfast. In 2019, a memoir called La Réconciliation. And in 2021, she published an oracle card set, L'Oracle des Mantras, with her illustrator husband, Bastien. For the past 15 years, she's been writing regularly to her fan base of tens of thousands on her website and in her newsletter. She produces videos on her virtual yoga and meditation studio, Lily Babary TV, and she records exceptionally heartfelt conversations on her podcast. Not only that, she's also in the middle of writing her first novel. She's kind of like the Oprah Winfrey of France, but don't tell her I said that. Lily and I met back in the early 2000s when she was working as a PR at the very edgy concept store Colette, and I was a new American beauty journalist in Paris. She was so sweet to me and so informed and passionate about the brands that she was representing and the stories behind them that we wound up becoming friends over the last two decades. We've also collaborated a bunch of times together on workshops and different types of creative projects. Having Lily on this show has been something I've been wanting to do before the podcast even existed, but I felt like I needed a little bit of time for the areas of Lily's extraordinary life to reveal themselves to me in terms of what I wanted to explore with her. She's so well known, she's given so many interviews, but her popularity isn't always rosy or simple, and despite what it may look like on the outside, it often stirs up some old wounds and inherited emotions about feeling illegitimate, being scared of being shamed and judged publicly, pursuing projects from a fear of lack rather than joy. And also there's an internal dance that goes on behind the scenes between knowing what to share spontaneously about your life and also feeling the need for self-preservation. And so these are all the things I really wanted us to dig into together. This is an unusual conversation. It's very intimate. It's also very precious to me. And I really hope that you take the time to go all the way through to the end. I know it's a jumbo size episode, but I promise it's going to be worth it. As always, please send me your feedback. You can reach me at ziva@zivabalel.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I can't wait to hear from you. Bye. Hi, Lily.
Hi.
Welcome to the show today. How are you doing?
Good, good. I'm just out from a class, from a yoga class, so I'm very good.
Okay, wonderful. I'm so excited that you're here with me today. This is sort of a milestone in our relationship because ordinarily you're the one interviewing me. I think this is the first time that I've actually interviewed you, which is...
Yeah, it's the first time.
It's the first time. So, just to set the context a little bit, we've known each other for something like 20 years, which is incredible. And we've grown quite a bit as confidants and collaborators since we've met. And I know you, in addition to that, through the eyes of my clients, because thankfully, a lot of the people who I coach discovered me through you and are big fans and followers of yours. And they look up to you and they say that they admire you for your voice, your opinion, the trajectory of your career, all the changes you've made. But sometimes they also say, I admire Lily, but I could never do X, Y, and Z in the way that she does. It comes so easily to her. And as your as your friend, I know that that's
it
not...
It doesn't come easily.
It doesn't come easily. That your journey has been filled and continues to be filled with moments of doubt and insecurity, vulnerability, confusion, all of the human feelings. So I would really like for this conversation to lift the veil a little bit on what it's really like to be you and to understand how you become who you are and what are some of the difficult decisions and discomforts that you face being somewhat of a public image today. So that's what I have in mind. Is there anything that you are interested or curious about exploring in your journey today?
The confusion between what people project about the image that they receive from you and the reality of what you are is something that is really, really interesting today, because we're in an era where we get very confused about what's true, what's false, what's fake, what's artificial, what really happens or not. And I think that the confusion rises with social media. It's very hard to know exactly where the person that you're looking at is in her journey or his journey. And even though now we know, because we've had a lot of people sharing their own vulnerable situations, we still get trapped into that feeling of thinking that the other person is doing better than we do. And yes, it's true. There's a lot of people who think that it's very easy for me, or I don't know, that, you know, I make tons of money, or that anytime I want to make a change in my life, I just, you know, snap my fingers and then it's done. And that I have more courage than another person, or, you know, and I think we're all different. What I know is that sometimes it's really not easy to be me, to feel me. And I wouldn't like to make people think that it's easier for me than for others. It's not true.
Well, that's a wonderful point of departure. I think that this notion of being subject to a lot of adulation and a lot of respect comes with a certain kind of price. And part of that is also being misinterpreted for who you are and not really being understood. And it's almost like, how much of yourself can you really share about all of those, you know, more intimate questions that you may have going on in the background? How much does it serve the public? How much does it serve you? So I think this is really kind of juicy nugget for us to dig into. I want to go back to when you were still working as a PR at Colette and I was still writing as a journalist. And I remember you inviting me over to your apartment. I think it was the first time that we kind of left the professional sphere and you kind of invited me into your personal world. And you confided in me that you were interested in writing, that you had been for years the supplier of great story ideas for journalists, but you were thinking about actually writing yourself. And I'm sure for people listening today who know you as La Plume, you know, very prolific, it's hard to imagine there was a time that you ever weren't writing.
I think I've always written. I've like, writing has always been here, and I've got tons of diaries since I was maybe, even when I was 8, 9, or 10, I used to write every day about what was going on in my life. So I think I was a very early blogger or vlogger or whatever. I've always written because it made me feel better. It made my mind clearer. And I needed it. So I kept on writing all the time. And I also loved writing letters. Before we had emails, I used to write very long letters to girlfriends of mine. I had some very nice friends who were male and who were not boyfriends. And we used to have amazing letters in between, like, you know, and I love the way you had to wait. You had to really put yourself into the letter. You wanted to share something. It was just like an essay, really, to send something like this. But then I came to the point where it was in 2002 or 3, I started thinking, how am I going to make money? Because what I was doing back then did not satisfy me anymore. I didn't want to be a PR anymore. and I had no idea of how I could make money. And this is something that came back again and again and again in my life. Like, how could I make money with something that I like and that I'm good at doing? And I was writing a lot of press releases, and we had a lot of brands that did not have enough money to have proper press releases because they were from abroad and they had press releases in English, but they were not fit to be sent to French journalists because there were not enough information inside them. So I started writing about beauty for the press to talk about products. And I kind of liked doing this. It was not to write about beauty that really interested me, but writing was what interested me at the beginning. And I thought maybe I could get out from the PR and start writing as a journalist because I knew a lot about beauty because I had been working in that area for a few years. And yes, I remember you coming to my place, and I remember something about that first rendezvous at my place. I think that French Vogue, who knew that I wanted to write because I had just quit my job as a PR and I didn't know what I was going to do. And they said, oh my God, like, you know, what are you going to do? And I was like, I don't know, I'd love to write, but I never thought that I could actually contact French Vogue to talk about this. Like, you know, it was not even in my dream area. And so I remember the journalist from French Vogue who said, why wouldn't you try something for us? Because she knew that I was writing press releases a lot. And she knew that I had a knowledge of beauty brands that was quite big. So she thought, like, you know, why wouldn't you try something? And then her boss, who became my boss, ordered me my first article. And when you came, I had just that article. It was my first, my very first. And I had to write something about Valentine's Day's perfumes, which was kind of like, you know, it's those perfumes that come out for Valentine's. They're very boring. I mean, most of the time they're very commercial. And I didn't know what to write about Valentine's Day. It's not even something that I celebrate myself. And I remember I had written a list of a sort of a lexical field, like all the words that I wanted to put into my article. And I told you about this. And you were like, oh my God, I don't write that way. Like, you know, I don't build my writing this way. It's funny that you start by listing the words that you'd like to find into. It was just a cloud of words that I thought were inspiring. And I really remember you saying, this is weird. Okay, like, why not?
That's so funny. I don't remember that part at all. I was probably like, wow, she's very organized.
I think you said that, like, you were, oh my God, you're so organized.
Right. That's still the reaction I have to. I was like, that's pretty next level. It's so interesting. The fact that you were already writing and you're in this environment and this is the next step for you. Do you think that had you not been in the fashion and beauty field, that you would have still found a way to make the next step towards writing and earning a living?
Yes, I have no doubt about this.
What do you think you would have been writing about had it not been about beauty and fashion?
Maybe about food, which I did later on, or maybe during my college years. So I was in La Sorbonne Nouvelle, which is one part of La Sorbonne in France, and I was studying English civilization, and I specialized in like British history in the 19th, especially in the 19th century. And I did something about Irish immigration in London. So that was one of my studies that I really wanted to focus on this because I knew Ireland very well. I lived in Ireland as a very, like, you know, when I was 18. And I really wanted to mix, like, you know, my passions. How could I keep a link with Irish people by doing something with my English studies, which were focusing on the 19th century? So I was trying to find a way to sneak in, like, you know, what I liked. And I was writing already. And I did a writing course in college for short stories in English. So I was writing in English with a woman who was amazing. I only did that for 2 years. But I remember that I used to write poems and short stories in English. I think my level of English at that time was amazing because I would not be able to write in English anymore. I don't read English enough now to do it. But you see, writing was really, it was my favorite thing also to do in class when I was in high school, like writing essays, organizing my thoughts, my mind. This was something that was really important to me and never left me. And then way later on, when I found yoga and meditation, writing became a tool of self-empowerment that was very important. But before that, when I started my blog, even in 2010, the idea was, how can I write more about other things that interest me and not just beauty? Because I just felt I did not have enough space to express myself with just the beauty section of a magazine.
Mm. There are some similarities and differences in our story as it relates to writing about beauty. I never had any like inclination to write. I actually felt like I was a terrible writer. I don't know if we ever had this conversation. It's somewhat of a source of like great shame. When I was a little girl, my dad, it was probably around, I was in maybe 9th grade. So that's the, 10th grade. So it's like, I'm in high school and I had a subject
tenth
that
grade
I...
10th grade would be which year in France?
So that would be, okay, I'm terrible with the equivalent. So 10th, it's like 10th, 11th, 12th. 12th, you graduate. So
okay,
3 years before what?
Okay, be back.
Right. So you're like
seconde.
16. It's probably how old? Yeah, Jeanne,
so
what
it's
is she?
Première or seconde. It's like my daughter's
right
year.
Okay, so imagine Jeanne. So it's we're talking about me at this point. I had a paper to write for a very kind of difficult social studies professor. And the question was, who would I want to have as the next president of the United States? And I had to choose a candidate and I had to defend my opinions and, you know, argue for their, you know, for their election. And my father got very enthusiastic about this and kind of usurped, completely hijacked the project and wrote the paper on.
About who?
About Ralph Nader. So Ralph Nader is like a very progressive, you know.
Never heard of him.
Yeah, he's, you know, he's like hardcore unionizer, defender of liberal right. You know, like he's staunch liberal. And I just kind of went with it. And what wound up happening is I wound up getting a terrible grade on the paper. And it's funny because what I internalized that, you know, the meaning that I derived from that situation was that I'm not a good enough writer. My father
wrote it.
Right. But it was like he wrote it. In my thought, it was like he wrote it because he didn't think I could write it myself. What I internalized was this message that he did that because I wasn't a good enough writer. And that's why he like jumped in and was like, okay, I'm going to save her. But it didn't work out. So I didn't believe that I was a good writer. And I just kind of fell into it in France. And it was by writing about beauty subjects that I was able to develop my creativity because I felt like there was so little to actually work with in terms of content, like an inspiration, that I had to find some other source of creativity and that the beauty was just almost like a blank canvas for me to invent things with. So beauty was kind of a way for me to discover my creativity. And for you, it was what?
For me, beauty was getting lucky because if I had known like years before that I would write about beauty for so long, because I did it for 15 years, I never thought I would do it, because I had no real interest in beauty. But I say that, and at the same time, there's not one person on this planet who would not have something to say about beauty. Beauty is amazing because it starts conversations with anyone. When I was working for Le Monde, I used to give away all the products, and it was amazing to see all the journalists from all areas, like very special, like some of them were specialized in politics, economy, or very specific and very serious matters. When we were doing these giveaways, I could see that it's a very universal subject. And to me, beauty got me to understand that there were some conversations that were universal. Even if you don't put any moisturizer or decide not to wash your hair, it's a choice. And you can actually argue about it. Like, you know, there's something that you need to say about, like, you know, how you want to introduce yourself to others. And I thought that was super interesting to have these conversations with.
So, yeah, so it's a reflection of, and it's the decisions or the non-decisions you make around beauty are a reflection of how you perceive yourself and your identity.
Of course. And what you want to share about yourself with the world.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, who is Emily Weiss, who started Glossier, the huge beauty brand in the US, now which is worldwide. But we had that passion in common. So that how can you start a conversation that would be so universal? Mm. When she started her own blog, like Into the Gloss, the reaction of the people, like the number of comments that came up about beauty was amazing. Like, why would people be so interested into arguing about a lip balm or, you know, the right orange blossom flower perfume? And people have something to say about this that, of course, goes way beyond the beauty industry. Unfortunately, the beauty industry takes advantage of that interest to take advantage of our curiosity about how we present ourselves to the world.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. You know, when you think about it, it's an intimate decision that you make. And there's a lot that's concentrated in those small choices that we make each day about how we perceive ourselves and what, you know, how we stand politically, how we stand ethically, how we stand, you know, in terms of the consumption trends that we want to ascribe to or not. I want to go a little bit further on this idea, you know, with you deciding to start your own lifestyle blog when you were at Vogue, which is like the next kind of chapter. But there was something, there was also some hesitation there. There was some kind of tension at the time, going back to this theme of the tension between intimacy and vulnerability and exposure. There were things that you were also a little bit nervous about, getting your voice out there beyond the you know, the cloak of being attached to a publication. And what were you scared of at the time?
First, I was scared of the judgment of people around me who worked in the same field, like the beauty industry, especially journalists. Because at the time, so it was in 2009 when I started thinking of that blog. It took me a year to actually launch it. I was scared because bloggers at the time, there were like not that many, but they were treated like shit by the press. They were seen as newcomers that had no knowledge, no experience, that had not gone to college to study the way journalists had gone to college, or blah, blah, blah. And they were seen as people who were going to chase the press, you know, out. And actually, the fear of journalists was actually very accurate, Because this is what happened. Like, you know, influencers kind they did not replace the press, but you see how the press is in a huge crisis. There's a lot of magazine which disappeared since then. So at the time, I knew that I was like kind of going into a direction in which it was not safe to go because it could jeopardize my kind of position at French Vogue. And also I was scared to attract attention on me, to be exposed, because I didn't want people to think that I wanted to become a celebrity. So what I did is that when I launched my blog, it was anonymous. There was no picture of me. There was not my name. It was not said that I was working for French Vogue. I was super scared that I would be, that someone would actually tell me like, so you're using the image of French Vogue to attract more attention. So I was very, very cautious with what I did. So of course, without showing my picture, without saying anything about me, without showing anything that was too personal, my blog became very small, very tiny. But this is, I think, what I wanted. And I remember having that conversation with Emmy Weiss, and she was, you know, sharing a lot of pictures about her, not on the blog so much, but like, you know, on Instagram, on social media. And she once asked me this question of like, why do you want to stay so small? Like, you know, why is it so important for you to stay so small? And I was very scared of how people were going to look at this, but not any people. It was more people who I used to meet and see every day in professional, like work lunch or at work lunch or the press launches that we used to do in the beauty area. And actually at the beginning, the way they welcomed my blog was not so nice. It was more like, you know, what is she doing? Like she wants to become famous or, you know.
That's what specifically people said? Or is that what you interpreted?
Both. Some of it was interpretation. Some of it was like stuff that I would overhear. But then, like, you know what? It made me feel so happy to do this that I overcame those fears. I mean, it's true that even today, there's some people in the beauty industry that can't stand me. I know they don't like me for what I'm doing or for what I did. And I don't like thinking of the way they don't like me. Of course, I don't want to focus on this. But to be honest, I don't really care. And I can't say that all the time. I mean, sometimes I care a lot about, like, you know, when people don't like me, it hurts me a lot. But about this, I thank myself so much for doing this project and for going through the fears that I had, because I would still be stuck in a position that I did not like. And I think that my vibration at that time was just frustration. And we don't need another person frustrated on this planet. There's so many. There's so many irritation, anger, and especially like absorbed anger that has not even been expressed. And I think that I'm better off with people not liking me, even hating me for what I'm doing, rather than staying small, hiding, and keeping all that anger and frustration inside of me. I don't think it's the right way for me to have a good impact in my life around me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way you'd say now, it sounds like you've really kind of come out of the process of being conscious of what people would think about you and being scared of ruffling people's feathers, being scared of having people consider you to be maybe ambitious, searching for celebrity or, you know, recognition. I think that that's something that here at least is a tricky subject, because it's not something that is celebrated in the culture.
Yeah, but it was not like I was not seeking for, of course, everyone is always seeking for recognition. There's not one person on this planet who doesn't want to be recognized for what he's doing. I think that people who say that they're above this are liars. But I was not looking for celebrity and fame. If I had looked for this, I would have done it very differently. I wanted to have fun again. I wanted to have to feel joy again in my life because I had been writing a lot, like, you know, about the same things. I had passed a time where I had no curiosity anymore. And I thought, like, you know, I need to find that joy again. I need to find that fun again. And so it was more like, oh my God, I want to feel that hit, you know, when you're just so happy about learning something new, about doing something new. Because when I started blogging, I had to learn about photography. I had never taken a photography before. And it was in 2009 when I started working on it, and the quality of phones was not good enough. So again, I felt really self-conscious about doing something that I had not get a training or an education about. Like, you know, it was just like, yeah. Oh my God. Even holding the camera in the street was like, oh, am I pretending I am someone who I'm not? Like, you know, am I playing a role that and I felt really self-conscious about what people would think. I had to overcome all my fears, like every day, like even doing editing or learning new skills. I had to go through all these fears and to go beyond them. And blogging was a great way to learn every day something new that I had never done. And also I had to keep up with the social media, which was something very new for me. I think that the first time I had a Facebook account was in 2007 when my daughter was born. And it was more to share, like, you know, pictures of her with some very close friends and family. And then it became what it is today. And then I was told by someone, oh, you should really start an Instagram account. And then you should start a Pinterest account. And you should have a Twitter account. And anytime someone would say, you should do this, I still have a huge resistance to it. Like, I'm like, oh my God, no, I can't do something new again.
I want to go back to this, the theme of, you know, you were saying when you were holding the camera, you felt almost like an imposter.
Yeah.
And yet you still went through with it. There's a quote that you have in La Réconciliation that I thought was really interesting around legitimacy. And you said, la légitimité ne se mesure pas dans le nombre de diplômes dont on dispose, elle naît en faisant. So legitimacy isn't measured by the number of diplomas you've earned, it's born by doing. But it sounds like that wasn't always the belief that you had, that the belief around legitimacy was more about diplomas and hard work, merit, even suffering. And it's something that I hear often as well with my clients. There's a certain kind of fear of being perceived as illegitimate, pretending to be someone who has the right to exercise whatever kind of profession or whatever kind of activity. And there's this fear in the background of maybe being exposed as an imposter. So what do you believe now about your own legitimacy versus the beliefs that you were exposed to as
you were growing up? I am not free from my education. And I think I have to deal with the way that I will never be free from it. It's part of my culture. It's part of what I've received, my inheritance. And some of it is good. Like today, we have this war in the Middle East that is so complicated. And I think that some people have no legitimacy to speak about it, like, you know, because they don't have enough knowledge. And sometimes it's good to be aware that you have no legitimacy about speaking of something that you don't really know, and that sometimes diplomas or research do mean something. And I think that behind that education, there's something good about it. It's not just something that makes you less than. Sometimes it's good to be aware that you're not so good at doing something, and that maybe it should push you in the direction where you're good at doing something. I don't want to share the idea or to teach the idea that whatever you want to do, you can do it. It's not true. It's not true. This is very American. You see, whatever you can do, like, you know, if you think of it, you can do it. It's not true. And this idea that whatever you can do it, like, is sometimes it makes you feel very guilty because you have all these ideas of if you want to do it, you can do it. Sometimes it does not just depend on you. It depends on the whole system. Like, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes it's very difficult to say no because you're in a system where people who've got power around you do not allow you to say no. So it's not just a question of, well, say yes, or, you know, or say, just say whatever you feel. Sometimes it's just not possible. So this idea of trying to become legitimate about something is not to be rejected totally, but being aware of what you can do and what you can do enables you to see the borders and to see if you can push them a tiny bit.
How does that apply to what you do as you are venturing into territories that are new for you? Be it, you know, going back to when you decided to become a yoga instructor. I mean, I know that there was also some of that attention around, well, is this a rightful place for me to be based on how yeah. you've already always been in your life? You know, so how do you navigate that when there's this, like, there's a desire, but then you don't know it, whether or not you actually have the space, have the right? How do you navigate that?
Still, I always have these questions on my mind. You know, there's some parts of me who still question myself about, like, you know, am I good enough? Is it my right place to teach? Like, for instance, because when you think of people who really, really know about yoga, of all yogas, if I see, for instance, a teacher of Iyengar, which is a very perfect yoga, you see people, they are so aligned, they have bodies who are athletic, it's just beautiful to see them. And when I look at myself, if I compare myself to them, I'm like, oh my God, like, you know, I just, who do I think I am? Like, you know, sharing my own practice. I'm not teaching the same yoga as them. But then at the same time, there's a strength, or there's a force, an energy that pushes me to try something and to see if it felt good. And if did it feel good also for the students around? Like, for instance, right now, like this morning, I gave a class. And if I focus on am I good enough to do the class, I'm not going to do it. But if I focus on do I want to do it, what kind of energy I want to share with the students, then I forget about those first questions. And the result is that we all came out from the class so happy, so relieved, with such a beautiful energy to bring on, like, you know, with our day and the rest of the week, that I'm like, okay, let's forget about the first question.
Right. You're able to bypass the first question, which is like, yeah. Am I good enough, with do I want to do it? And is this going to be an enjoyable experience for yourself and for others?
And also, for instance, I'm writing a new book, and it's a novel. It's the first time that I'm writing a novel. And so it's a different adventure of the ones that I did before. And I'm divided in between two feelings. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, like, what am I doing? I can't do this. Like, you know, I'm not supposed to do this. I'm not a novelist. Like, you know, this is ridiculous. And then I have so much fun doing it. Like, you know, I'm so excited to write and to read actually the following chapters. I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait. I can't wait to see what's going to happen, like, you know, next chapter. That I'm like driven faster than this part of me, which is trying to push me backwards and say, like, you can't do this. It's always going to speak inside of me anyway. Like, you know, I hear it all the time. Sometimes I give it a a lot of focus, a lot of attention on this voice. And these days are more difficult. But I am always aware that this voice, which is saying you're not good enough, is not someone exterior of me. It's still me.
Mm-hmm.
And this part of me is trying to defend me from shame. It's trying to protect me from bad situations afterwards. And sometimes you need to listen to this voice also, because this voice has some wiseness or some, well, no, how would you say?
Wisdom, but I like wiseness.
Wisdom. Some wisdom. Yeah, this voice has some wisdom to share too, like, you know.
Yeah.
We should not, like, you know, not listen to the voices and push them away, but just see what the energy is. Because sometimes the wisdom is like, don't do it and you should not do it.
Well, I mean, the thing that it keeps coming up and I think is so interesting is the flavor of that, the voice that you describe, the not good enough voice, is it's cloaked in this shame, like a shaming protection, like a protection against feeling
of shame,
humiliated and and embarrassed and shamed. And so I even want to push back a little bit. I think that, you know, there are these protecting voices that we have. And then it's about thinking about, like, what is this voice trying to protect me from? And how relevant is it to your current situation? And I don't know, actually, this is like something I'm fascinated by, because this is a voice that a lot of the clients that I work with have. It's a fear-based voice that is about protecting from almost like public shaming. And I find it like very fascinating, because it almost kind of like takes you to medieval times. I mean, like being, you know, humiliated in the public square, or you know, and I guess like social media is now our modern day version of that.
But we've all been through this when we were in school. Like, you know, if you go to any kindergarten in between classes, children, they have very long, passionate games, like, you know, in between each other. And there were a lot of reports, like documentaries, about what was going on those playgrounds. The level of hatred in between children, of harsh sayings like, you're not my friend anymore, you can't, you play the prisoner and you're going to stay out and away from us for a very long time, or it's not even in a game, like, you know, the exclusion, the shaming, the I don't like your hair, I don't like your nose, your hair are too short, your hair are too long, or whatever. It's just horrible. And we forgot about it, but we all have been through this. Mm-hmm. And whether we were the victims or not of this, we have all seen it. Like, you know,
yeah,
it's war. It really is war. Like, you know, in between very young kids. And of course, sometimes they play very nicely, you know, but most of the time they just fight each other and they say horrible things to each other. And they learn how to become social animals, like, you know, through these experiences. And I think because we have been through this, and also because we have been through at school people saying, oh, you could have done better. And especially in France, we have always heard a lot of stuff like with comparison, with grades, and with feeling not good enough. Of course, you end up not wanting to feel those feelings again, ever.
Yeah.
So you do whatever you can not to feel them. But if you go too far into that protection, you're not going to leave anything.
Yeah.
You're not going to do new experiences, because you're always going to fear that someone judges you. And of course, you're going to be judged and criticized.
Right. Well, this is like the internal debate and I guess work is to almost allow yourself to acknowledge the pain of the past shaming that occurred and kind of accompany yourself through whatever it is that you want to tackle today with a certain amount of openness to feeling feelings that are not nice without going into the place of keeping all of your armor up and not allowing yourself to experiment and learn and fall and be criticized or maybe, you know, be mocked. Because if you keep yourself in that territory of safety, then you prevent yourself from experiencing new things. Like, and you,
yeah,
you stay in the safe space, like in a frustrating situation at work that makes you miserable. So I always feel like this is where the work is.
You have to find a balance, and especially like, where can you express more and where you should express less? Where you should protect yourself more and where you can actually take more risks. And with the social media today, especially on Instagram, for instance, because this is where I share the most, I have lost a lot of spontaneity. Yeah. I used to be more spontaneous. I used to be more, I don't know, not caring really about what people think.
Mm-hmm. And kind of like insouciant, like just kind of playful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I don't know. Oh, this is a new cup. I like it. I'm just going to speak about it. And now there are some certain days I don't even share anything because I'm like, oh, why bother? I'm going to get so much criticism for whatever I do.
What I see in your appeal to people is your vulnerability, is your ability to kind of talk through the moments where you're feeling fragile, feeling doubtful, going through some kind of journey. And it would be a real disadvantage, I think, and a shame for you to have to hide who you are out of fear of being misunderstood or judged.
Sometimes people would like to have my opinion on a lot of different matters, and I decide quite wisely, I think, to shut down, to not share, because I don't want to become a punching ball?
Punching bag.
Punching bag. Yeah, in France we say punching ball. Yeah, I don't want to become a punching bag for people to release their own anger.
Yeah.
But I love being spontaneous, and I think this is where I'm good at. I think I'm good at, you know, expressing honest, vulnerable stuff and how I manage to go through them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that maybe sometimes among people who have paid for you to share those feelings, or, you know, to share the texts that I write or whatever, the relationship is a bit different.
Yeah.
I'm really thinking of this right now. It's something that I've made people used to having everything for free.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it say? Like, you know, at the end of the day, it says maybe I'm free myself. I don't have any value. What I say doesn't have any value. So if it doesn't have any value, you can criticize. You can actually send your anger at it. Like, you know, it's for free.
I don't know, but this is such an interesting, the subject of sharing and why we share. I think that as a journalist too, there's not only a curiosity, but there's also a kind of like reflex and a practice that you have of when you come across something that you like or that is, you know, thought provoking, that's touched you, there, that's transformed you. There's this desire to share, almost. I mean, I find that reflex almost like, you know, wanting to expose yourself as if you were writing in your diary. It's something that says like, this has marked my day. This has marked my moment. This has shifted something in me. And yet when that can kind of like boomerang back at you and become, you know, a source of your own pain, you know, where the intention and the impact are two different things. And you can't control the way that people are going to react to what you share.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be such a, I don't know, I feel like it would be such a disservice for you to edit what you share, but maybe finding the better environment for it seems like the next step is like, okay, so you, how to continue to keep so that sharing flow going.
If I had a private Instagram account for people who are really choosing me and maybe a smaller community, and if you know who they are because they have, I don't know, subscribed, so you know exactly who they are. And if their behavior is not respectful, then it's they're just out, like, you know.
Yeah.
Imagine the level of conversation that we can create with this. It's totally different. Like, you know, when you invite friends at your home, you can argue. You're not going to be all agreeing on something, but you're going to do it with the respect and also because you know you have something in common that is stronger than all the disagreements, you know. So I think it's just a question of, I don't want to change myself. I want to be as honest as possible, as sincere as possible. But I think that depending on the days and on the subjects, there are certain fields of conversation that cannot be shared on Instagram anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a quote I want to, do you know Mary Carr? She's a memoir author and she wrote a book called The Art of Memoir. And she says that the goal of a voice is to speak not with objective authority, but with subjective curiosity. What do you think is the goal of your voice?
I don't know. I saw a video of myself that dated back from 2019 when I was promoting the launch of my book, La Réconciliation. And there was a journalist asking me, like, you know, what is, do you know now what is your mission? And I was really radical at that time with my yoga practice. So I answered with a big smile, oh, yes, I know.
I've got it all figured out.
And I saw that video again and I thought, oh, my God, like, you know, I didn't say that. Did I say that? And I think I was under the influence of so many yoga teachers around me who had told me that my mission was to open. I was a way opener. I was a light worker, like, you know, sharing the light around. And I, you know, I love that idea that I had a special mission. And I think that today I have no clue about what my voice is supposed to share. I don't know what is my goal. I don't know what is my mission. I don't know. But I'm trying to be a mother. I'm trying to be a wife. I'm trying to be a friend. I'm trying to be a woman. I'm trying to be a novelist. I'm trying to be a yoga teacher. I'm trying to be a content developer. I'm trying to do my best with all of these jobs, one at a time. And sometimes there's some days I'm doing good at being a mother. And sometimes I'm failing very much at whatever it is that I'm trying to do. I didn't know at the time, but I had been convinced by some others that my mission was something. And I thought, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, why not? The more you think that you're unique and special, of course, it makes you feel good. But at the same time, it's just a lot of weight.
Mm.
We're all unique. We're all special. But at the same time, we're so many. Like, you know, we're billions on this planet. And we're just trying to do our best at an era which is very difficult. And I think that without trying to have super high goals and ambitions, but just the ambition of doing our best today with who we are and what we have to do. And we're going to fail at a lot of stuff, but we can just, like, you know, focus on the next half hour, the next day or the next week. And this is a lot enough already, to my opinion.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot. That's already a lot. But it's, for me, it's like, it's a little different than the idea of a mission and just your voice. Because for me, when I think about everything you've just said, that is what I see you do all the time, is show up as someone who is as honest as she is comfortable being about all of the difficulties in working towards those objectives.
For me, the most difficult thing in life is injustice, like when things are not fair. And I hate when people are lying about themselves. I have a way to see it. I see it very easily. And I've seen it since I was very little, because there were a lot of people lying around me, and sometimes not even knowing that they were lying about themselves. And if I feel really bad or sad or uncomfortable, lying about how I feel takes too much energy from me. It's just, I can't do it. And I can't, I mean, I wish I could lie very easily, but I'm just so bad at this. I really am. And when I'm wrong at something, because of course it happens, I swear I'm very honest about doing it so wrongly. Like, you know, there's some belief systems that I really believed in for a while. And when I did, even though I was wrong, I was so honest with it. And today when I, you know, when I realized that maybe, yeah, I was not on the right track, I forgive myself, because at least I was really honest doing it wrong.
That could be an amazing book title.
Be honest at fucking it up.
The honest path of doing it wrong. But it's true. There's this authenticity when you're making those decisions that you thought were right. You really believe they were right, but you have the ability with objectivity later on in your life, or with new information that, you know, discloses itself, to backtrack and be like, actually, maybe I wasn't doing the right thing, but you were doing the right thing that you believed was the right thing at that moment.
And also, we all have a different pace or rhythm about understanding where we're at. Like sometimes you desire something very strongly and you think that you desire it for good reasons. But then after a while, you understand that they were linked to your feeling of lack, to your feeling of not feeling good enough about yourself.
Mm.
And I have this image of, you know, when you're stuck running in a circle and your feeling of lack is behind you, and you try to run after something that is going to make it go away, but the feeling of lack is always behind you. So you can run as much as you want because you're stuck in a circle. At one point or another, whether you have as much money as you want, or the biggest house, or the biggest recognition, let's say you have the Goncourt, which is a huge prize, or the Nobel Prize of Literature, or whatever, if you're a writer, and you think that it's going to make your feeling of lack go away, it will not, because you're running in a circle. So you're going to meet your feeling of lack at one point or another. It will always be there. So the idea is just sometimes when you see that you're doing things because of this, because you're trying to escape from it, you stop, you feel where it is in your body. Like, you know, how does it make you feel to feel not good enough, you know, that you're lacking something. And it's so uncomfortable, but you go inside of this in your body, like, you know, you really mm-hmm. breathe into it and it dissolves. It doesn't go away, but you can actually be with it and see that, oh, maybe I'm just going to make another decision, because it's just going to stay. It's still here. Mm. And maybe I can transform it, you know, with another strategy than just escaping from it, like, you know, and running as fast as I can from it. It just doesn't work.
Well, it sounds like you've got experience with this.
Oh, yes. Every single day.
It's not something you've just read in a book. It sounds like you've got some long hours practicing this.
Yeah, and it's just, I had a project for the past 6 or 9 months. I had been working on a project that I will not share with you today because it's very confidential. But I was ready to push on that button where you actually launch it, like, you know. And it was huge. It was a lot of money and a lot of work. If I had started it like right now, I don't think that we would have the time to have that conversation because I would be overwhelmed with work. And all of a sudden, I was really just about to launch all of it. And I thought, is this really what I want? Why do I want this so bad? And all of a sudden, it just became very clear that I wanted to have a narrow escape from a situation that I was feeling right now and that was really uncomfortable. And I didn't want to feel that discomfort anymore. So I thought that jumping on a new project would that discomfort disappear. When I touched that, like, you know, when I targeted that feeling, I thought, okay, let's wait until the discomfort is released from my body and then I can launch a new project. But I cannot launch a new project to escape from that. Like, you know, it's not comfortable. I'm not happy about this, but I have to face it or else I'm just going to create another catastrophe in my life by escaping from it. And I really, really, truly believe in it. And I thought, okay, I'm lucky enough because I came to realize it before launching it. So you see, it's linked to a feeling of lack, of lack of recognition, lack of love, lack of whatever. Like, you know, I was so attached to the lack that I thought if I create abundance, then I'm going to diminish that feeling of lack. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
So I stopped everything. I paused and I thought, what do I want to do? I want to write. What do I want to feel? I want to feel joy and the flow and fluidity and okay, am I okay right now? Am I safe money-wise? Yes, I am. So I can take more time to think about this. Yes, I can. Okay, so let's wait for another few months. Let's do what I'm doing and trying to improve myself at what I'm doing right now and not start something new without clearing out that discomfort, because I'm super, super good at running away from stuff that are discomfortable.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. It's such a huge example of how you have been doing the work on yourself to be able to identify when you're operating from that fear of lack, but then to intercept it with so much riding on that push of the button. This leads me to the questions that I've been wanting to ask so far about, you know, light things like intergenerational trauma and emotional inheritance, which is a subject that we love to talk about, light stuff. You mentioned in Reconciliation, it was interesting, I hadn't heard you say, we hadn't talked about it, but how your grandmother, you felt like she had a fear of lack, having left kind of hastily Algeria to move to France, and that you saw it in the accumulation of stuff that she had, and that you kind of recognize that in some of your own behavior. How do you think you've been shaped consciously or unconsciously by that fear of lack by the people who lived before you?
I think the inheritance of traumas in one's families are so huge. And not just in my family, but in dysfunctional families, they're even bigger. And the inheritance of beliefs that we have linked to money, to having enough, are very, very strong. And they shape us in a way. So I had two different grandmothers, one who was Jewish, one who was Catholic. And both of them were... they had a lot of practice of their religion. I mean, they were not just believers. They did practice a lot. Mm-hmm. But my parents, both of them, decided not to share any religion at home. they were atheists, it was very important for them to let us free with our beliefs. And it was something in the 70s, I think, that was shared among a lot of adults and parents. A lot of people from my generation did not have any religious education. But what I saw looking at my two grandmothers is that I could see, as I was a very young child, that they did not come from the same culture. They did not come from the same social background, and they did not have the same fears. They did not have the same education. My grandmother, who came from Algeria, could barely read and write. She could write her name, but it was very difficult for her to write her name. And she could not read a recipe in a book. So imagine a world where you live in France and you don't understand the world around you. She had a phone with huge numbers where she could see the digits to actually phone the people that she loved. And of course, she could read a bit, but like very little. And she lived in a very small flat outside in the suburbs in a building that was built in the 60s for mostly immigrants, people from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Italy, Spain. So there were not like, you know, French people from France in that building. It was very poor. And I could really see that she was struggling, even though the tables that she used to share, like for parties, for dinners, they were amazing. There was always too much food and an empty plate for the friend or the person who did not have money, who could actually come. It was a tradition at my place, like at my grandmother's, to actually set a place for someone who could actually arrive, and you would still have enough food for everyone. All of this built me. It shaped me in a way that I thought, even though I loved her, I was pretty scared to end up in her building. There was a lot of violence. The woman above her flat was beaten up by her husband. We could hear it. Oh. I mean, I can still hear the sound of when I was, like, you know, sleeping at her place, of the screaming of that woman above us. There was a scent of pee in the lift and in the staircase, because there was a lot of people and of young people who were peeing in the staircase. So the smell was absolutely horrible. There were some graffiti, like insults, you know, writing mm-hmm. on the walls. And all of this participated into scaring me of that world, like, you know, because I was raised in a very different neighborhood. And I remember that there was a lot of love around the table. There was a lot of generosity. But me as a child, I was kind of scared of being stuck there. And I know that this feeling, my mother had it too, because the first thing that she did when she was old enough was to leave that place and to go to London to learn how to speak English. And there's a lot of people who came from that building who shared the same feelings, like, you know, like, let's get out of here because it's so violent. It's not just being poor, because poor is something else. It's more like feeling excluded from the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. I'm very connected to this memory, and I don't want to forget about it because it's my roots. But I see that in my ambitions in being an adult, it shaped them into not wanting to feel what is not having enough. But you see, I think that if my mother listened to our podcast, she might do. She hates when I speak about her family as being poor, mm-hmm. because to her, it's like an insult, even though it is true. Like, you know, they did not have a lot. They had very, very less. And especially when they were children, like, you know, in Algeria, but she doesn't like it because she takes it as something insulting.
And so your mom was born in Algeria?
Yes, when Algeria was still French. And so she was born French there. And she had to leave in 1962 when the war happened. Of course, I wasn't with her because I wasn't even born. But when you have in your history families who left their home, there's a trauma which is really, really big. Home is like your motherland, like, you know, mm-hmm. So it's your mother. It's your, you grew up and you think that you're at your place and then you have to leave. And whatever the reasons were, and I'm not going to speak about politics behind it, but like, you know, it's a huge trauma to leave your place and to restart something new where you are not welcomed mm-hmm. because they were not welcome. Some of them had to change their accents because they had a specific accent in French that would identify them as not being part from France, really. And even though they had a French ID, they were not considered as French as other French people who were born there. Mm. And it was the same for immigrants. So you see, I mean, this idea of not being as good as others is something that is, it's a pain and it's an injustice that I can still feel mm-hmm. and that hurts me. And anytime there's someone who's not accepted for how they were born, whether they're Jewish, Muslim, or blonde hair, black skin, or whatever, it just hurts me, like in my stomach, like in my blood, in everywhere. Like, you know, it's just a real pain.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the injustice because there seems to be a correlation there too, with a real like heightened awareness to being judged, right? Unfairly, being labeled, your value being somewhat predetermined, right? By stereotypes or just lack of information, lack of knowledge, lack of empathy. So it's just really interesting that the connections to, you know, inheriting this feeling of not having enough and not wanting to be stuck there, not wanting to have that be your fate forever, that you can do something about it, being a source of motivation, but it could also kind of dip into, as you were saying earlier, trying to escape this feeling of not having enough and then almost exhausting the resources in order to no longer feel that fear. So you have this in you. How is the work that you do with your body, you know, like grounding your body and the writing in a way part of a practice or a ritual or some kind of healing strategy to free yourself from the patterns that are not productive for you?
A few years back, I would have used the word freedom. Now I tend to use other words because I don't believe in absolutely healing anymore.
Okay.
I don't think that you absolutely heal from everything or that it should be your goal to heal from all of this. There are some wounds that I will not heal from. I don't want to victimize myself by saying that, but it's just accepting the fact that these wounds will be walking with me. And I prefer to see that it's wounded rather than trying to stitch it, like, you know, all the time, because it's just too much energy, like, you know, from me. So In my work with the writing, with my obsession to understand, like, you know, how it's working in my head or in my body, I think it's more of a curiosity to understand how do my thoughts are made of? What are they made of? Like, you know, do they really belong to me? Or do they belong to my 16-year-old self, to my 5-year-old self? It's always been fascinating to me to try to understand, like, you know, who's speaking, what voice it is, like, you know, right now. Am I honoring really all of the voices or just one? And why am I focusing on one rather than the other? And why should I be so judgmental with all of them? Like, you know, some of them may not be nice to hear, but they might have a great message for me. So it's not about healing. It's more about trying to be as curious as I can about what's going on in my body and with me. And I don't know, I think it was easier when I had the belief that I was on a mission and I was moving forward to more light, for instance, or that all of this had meaning. Now I don't know. And I'm with more doubts than before, but I prefer myself being doubtful than when I had some so-called certainties, because you cannot stay certain for a very long time. So it becomes a sort of posture of like, I'm certain, like, you know, and I prefer to be full of doubts, not knowing, but staying curious about what's going on, like, you know. So this is what I do with the writing. This is what I do with my body. I don't know. Sometimes I would like to have a magic wand and to get rid of all the shitty stuff that I feel. But I, because maybe I'm older, I'm kind of like, okay, the shitty stuff is not going to move away with a magic wand, nor something special that you do for once, like, you know, but maybe I can get curious about that shitty stuff, like, you know, I can get curious about it and dig into it and see what's going on. Yeah.
Getting curious about the shit. It's another title.
Let's create our own publishing house.
So we could just get like a memoir title generator, you know. But that's, I feel like it's such a humble place to be, and maybe also liberating to not have the weight of feeling like you should know and have the certainty to embrace that, the messiness of it's just, you're human walking with the wounds, and your job isn't to heal them completely, but to get curious about what they're about and what they're indicating for you. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. I have one last question, and that's based on what we've talked about today, what we've explored. What have you discovered about the woman you're becoming more of?
The more I evolve, the more I get nicer to myself. And this is something very new, because I used to be trying to escape or to fight, you know, to really resist, control. And even in my yoga practice, I was really like, you know, putting so much strength into it. And now I think that the woman I'm becoming is maybe kinder to herself. And I think that despite all I have said about the period that we're facing, there's still a lot of hope inside of me. And I don't want to lose this. I want to make sure that the woman I am becoming stays hopeful.
Thank you so much, Lily, for your time, for your wisdom. It is such an honor to have you in my life and a pleasure. And I'm so grateful for all of these years, friendship and camaraderie.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention, and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, It would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.